Welcome to Keeping It Real with Frankie D, an Italian-American podcast at ItalianAmericanLife.com. And I am your very proud host, Frankie D. And today is the fourth part of our podcast series on Christopher Columbus. And I am partnered with Carla Simonini, the director of the Paul and Ann Rubino Italian-American Studies Program at Loyola University in Chicago. And Carla, I do want to say thank you for this tremendous opportunity to be a part of this wonderful series of podcasts on Christopher Columbus. And today, is our guest is Fred Gardafe, a distinguished professor of English and Italian-American Studies at Queens College and the John D. Calandra Italian-American Institute.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
Thank you. Thank you both. Welcome to the show. And Carla, I understand you have a very interesting story to share about Professor Fred.
Yeah, I would love to share a little story. Thank you, Professor Gardafe, for joining us. And Frank, thank you too. I wouldn't be able to do this without you. This has been a collaboration. So I met Professor Gardafe virtually at first. My story, I think, is typical of a lot of other Italian Americans. I grew up knowing I was Italian American. My father had a lot of pride in our heritage, and he did a lot of work with our genealogy. And through a bunch of circuitous routes, I ended up in a PhD program in Italian literature, more or less, Italian studies, which was a very literary-based, cultural, historical, literary-based program for my PhD program. And I was surprised when I got there. I was the only American in the program. Everybody else in the program were Italians from Italy who had already earned their laurea in Italy and had come over and were getting a PhD at American University. And, you know, I became friends with many of them, and all of them now are the vast majority of them now are teaching in U.S. universities, different fields of Italian literature, film, culture, whatnot. And while I was there, I was a little intimidated. I thought, well, I don't have their, you know, vast cultural background. And when it came time to choose my dissertation topic, I thought, does the world need me as a Dante scholar? There are other people out there that can do that. And by this time, it took me a while to finish my program. The department had grown and changed and become more interdisciplinary. We had new hires, one in comp lit, one in history, and it had become a true Italian studies program. So I had the ability to propose an interdisciplinary dissertation topic, which looked at the narrative of Italian American identity as it unfolded in mostly American literature, but also with making connections to the cultural and historical context in Italy, which spurned the Great Migration to the United States. And because there was no one in my department with any expertise in that area whatsoever, I reached out to Professor Gardafe, who was already a distinguished professor in the field and had published different works, and very tentatively said, "Hi, you don't know me. I've got this idea for a dissertation. I'm sure you'd be thrilled to take on, you know, extra unpaid work for someone you don't even know in a university that you're not affiliated with." And, you know, to my great delight, he said yes and became the most important person in my dissertation committee, and has been a big part of my mentorship ever since then, and actually led me to apply to the position I currently hold at Loyola, which is an endowed position of Italian American studies by Paul and Ann Rubino, who were the major donors who put up the large donation to make the endowment possible. So I would not be here doing this series had I not reached out to Professor Gardafe, and had he not very generously offered his time and has given me his continued mentorship to move forward. So that was kind of a long story, but I wanted to share it because it's very meaningful to me. So
may I just say to Fred, thank you from the people of Chicago, because we're so happy to have Carla Simonini here in Chicago.
Thank you. I'm very proud of the work that she's done, but she's earned this position. It's not something she just kind of walked into. When I first met Carla, I met her writing probably more, you know, spent more time with her writing than I had in person. I didn't actually meet her, I think, until the dissertation defense.
The actual dissertation defense is the first time we met in person.
Right. And at that time, I had left Chicago. I was hoping and dreaming to create Italian American Studies in Chicago. I was doing some work with Dominic Candeloro And I was trying to have, I had a course here and there at Columbia College where I was teaching, but we weren't able to get the community around the idea of putting up some money and investing it in education. So when I was offered the job at Stony Brook University back in 1998, I said, I better go there because before it happens in Chicago, I will be an old man. And when I was there to help inaugurate the Paul and Ann Rubino chair at Loyola University for Carla, I was invited to come and give a talk. And what I realized was that as I was preparing for that talk was that this was my dream job. The job that she was getting was the job that I had always dreamed of and had never been able to accomplish. And indeed, I'm towards the end of my career now, but I am so glad that it happened because Chicago is the place where I was born and raised. I grew up in Morrow's Park. I went to Fenwick High School. From there, I went up to the university. I went to Triton Junior College and then to University of Wisconsin, University of Chicago, and I ended up at the University of Illinois. So I left Chicago very reluctantly, but very certain that I would, you know, not be able to create Italian American studies as quickly there as I was able to work with it in New York. And as I was working on the field and people like Carla would come up to me and ask me for help, I didn't hesitate at all because that was something that I needed back when I was in school. I was not allowed to do my dissertation on Italian American literature when I was at the University of Chicago. They just weren't interested in it at all. And I ended up at the University of Illinois doing it. And so I decided that I was going to try to be there for everybody who needed the help because when I needed the help, there was nobody there to help me. Eventually, some of the people in the Italian American Studies Association kind of rallied around my cause, but there weren't professors of Italian American Studies back then. The first one really didn't happen until the position that I have right now at the Calandra Institute happened. And so now I think there's probably 5 or 6 professors of Italian American Studies around the country, and it is a legitimate field, a field that's growing, that's thriving. We get new participants every year, and it's great that Carla is there now to nurture that next generation, because that's what it's all about. It's about that next generation.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that mentorship is so important. I think I have paying it forward too. That's definitely something that's a lesson I've taken from you, that the importance of having somebody who believes in you and paying it forward. And also, I mean, it can't be underestimated that you're a labor of love too, you know, wow, that invested in this on so many levels, and that there's value in it, not only within the Italian American community, but it's a legitimate field of inquiry. It has lots of ties with other disciplines, and it's so timely what's going on with the world, as this series is demonstrating. So,
well, this whole field has become so much a part of my life that when people, I'm past retirement age, and people say, well, when are you going to retire? I said, this is my life. I can't retire from my life. I'll retire when I don't enjoy this. I have been fortunate enough in my career to have a job that I have loved every single year for the past 46 years. I have loved my job. And, you know, it's not always been the greatest paying job, but I've always gotten by, always taken care of my family, and have always been able to wake up in the morning and be incredibly happy to be working on what I'm working on. So,
and to be honest, I think you're very few people could say that.
I didn't have those jobs before. I've had the jobs that you never wanted to retire from in the past, but once I got into teaching in academia, I found my place, and you know, and I'm not going to let it go anytime soon. That's for sure.
Well, that's wonderful. Excellent. Well, let's talk a little bit about, what does it mean to be an Italian American in the 21st century?
That's great.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to break in and say part of the reason why we invited you, Fred, is to talk about Beyond Columbus. That's our topic today. And up until this point, we've been interviewing people about, you know, the very complicated history of Columbus, the history of the holiday. And we reached out to you in particular. One of your most recent articles that you published was, I think that was its exact title, Beyond Columbus. I can share a link to it afterwards. And we're so vested. I remember one of the things, a quote right from that article, it's time to move beyond Columbus and focus on educating everyone about what it is real, what it is that really matters to Italian Americans. So to Frank's point, maybe you can help.
Right. No, I think being Italian American is understanding our own culture first. One of the things that happened, I spent my life studying Italian-American culture, and I would be the first one to say, I don't think I really know a lot about it, even though people say, well, you're the professor of the field, you should know. And the more I study, the more I learned, and it won't stop. It means knowing the past, knowing what was going on in Italy. Why did everybody leave? My grandmother used to say, you know, I say, Grandma, why did you leave Italy? She goes, miseria, miseria, I don't want to talk about it. So I just kind of, you know, and whenever somebody said the word miseria, it was just something you didn't go near, you know, it was just leave it alone, miseria. And so what happened was, I began studying why did my family come to the, you know, and people will say, well, they came for a better life. But what was wrong with the life that was in Italy then? So we have to understand our past, and that's probably it. And very few of us know the past except through our families. Mm. And that's sometimes rare. You know, there's a lot of stuff in the past that our families don't want to talk about. A lot of people left Italy and they don't want to talk about where that came from. My grandmother was one of those. My grandfather was a little bit more nostalgic about Italy, primarily when he was working in the garden and so on, or when we were out in the fields by the forest preserves picking cicoria. You know, what am I doing in the woods picking mushrooms and then going out into the fields near Kittyland I think that's River Grove or that area, and picking these weeds out of the field that dogs are peeing on, and you know, what the heck is this? Why are we doing this? So it's a matter of understanding that past, not just from what it is our own perspective of our family, but what was going on in the nation. And we never got that in history books at all. As I say, we used to get the two C's about Italians in American history. We would get Christopher Columbus, and then we would get Al Capone. And besides that, there were very rare occasions where we would begin to understand. And maybe at some point, if we studied immigration, A lot of people from Europe came over when things were bad there. But what was it that made things bad there, and why did they leave? The first time I went back to Italy, I was the first one of my family to ever go back to Italy. And I went back in 1978, I was 25 years old. And I said, why did they ever leave this beautiful place? Who would ever want to leave this place? And I started talking to my relatives over there who stayed, and they said, we couldn't feed everybody. You know, we fed everybody as best we can. My grandfather was the only one who came to America. All the rest of his brothers and sisters stayed. A couple of went to Brazil and Argentina. But the idea was that, you know, it's, and even they didn't understand why they were so poor. They didn't go to school. They, you know, they would just know whatever conversation was going on around the piazza or something, or what they may have picked up from other people reading a newspaper for them. And so when I began to investigate that, I began to realize that it wasn't the huddled masses yearning to breathe free who came to the United States. It was the hardworking people who wanted to live better. And they didn't understand what it was. They didn't understand their economy. They didn't understand the politics. They just understood that life had to be better somewhere else. And so these were the people who came, not when we opened up the jails of Europe and all the terrible people came over because they couldn't get survive over there. No, that wasn't it at all. And when you begin to understand that, you begin to see not only Italian Americans in different life, but all the other ethnic groups and all the other racial groups that came to the United States one way or another. And when you know and understand your own story, you're more likely to accept and understand somebody else's story. So those are the reasons I think that, you know, education is the most important. And it's not going to just happen in the home. It's not just going to happen in the neighborhood. When I was a kid, I lived in a little Italy, and Italy lived in my neighborhood. People still spoke Italian. People talked about Italy. These are people who had come from Italy. They spoke in broken English, or they spoke in dialect or something, but they did have a sense of Italy. I only have a sense of Italy from their stories. And so that's how I fashioned my identity. And it wasn't a very good identity. My identity came more from watching television and whatever was talked about in schools. And my stories were never talked about in schools. And so when I got to the point, when I came back from Italy, is when I met Dominic Candeloro, and I became what I call sometimes obnoxiously a born again Italian. You know, I wanted everybody to speak Italian. I ran all over the place to try to find people who spoke Italian. I started working for the Franoi for free as a, you know, they didn't publish fiction in the Franoi, at least not that they knew of. There was a lot of fiction in there, but it wasn't artistic kind of fiction, made up stories perhaps or something. And I decided that, you know, they needed to have an arts and culture section in the Franoi, not just a we used to call grip and grin, the pictures where people who were donating money to Bella Scalabrini would take their picture with Father Pierini or Father Cozzi. And, you know, that would go out there and everybody would donate money to the villa and so on and so forth. And we were more than that. And I think this was the impetus. And so studying this, but then the key also was going back to Italy. And when I first went back to Italy, I thought I was speaking Italian. I went to Venice and, you know, I thought I was speaking Italian. And the clerk at the hotel said, would you prefer to speak English? And I said, no, I'm speaking Italian. He goes, I don't know. You could be from Mars. I have no idea what you're saying. Even when I went down to Castellana Grotte in Puglia, just south of Bari, where my mother's parents both were born, I started speaking and the people would laugh at me. And my uncle dragged me and he brought me into the piazza. And he said, speak to these men. And I started speaking to the old men and they were laughing. And this old man came up and he pinched my cheeks and he says, you are so young to speak so old. Mm-hmm. And then they started telling me stories about my grandfather, what a rascal he was, and how when he... the day that he was going to go to the United States, he took his zappa, his hoe, mm-hmm. and he put it up in the tree and he shot it with a shotgun. He had been given a shotgun when he was a soldier in World War II and he never returned the weapon. It would have been World War One.
World War One, yeah.
World War One. And so they told me that story. When I came back and told, by then my grandfather had been dead, but my grandfather never told me that story. So then I started getting this new understanding of Italy and I had this embarrassment about what I was speaking. So I came back and I started studying with Edie Krause at Northwestern University. She was a TA in the Italian department and they had this thing in the reader where you could sign up for classes. I can't even remember what it was called. It was a it was way, way before the internet and all that. And I met with Edie for one day every Wednesday for 4 years. And she took me through first, second, third, fourth year Italian. And went beyond that, I started translating. And one of the things I translated were the letters. My grandmother gave me this box after she said, here, you can have this. Nobody else could read Italian. And I started reading the letters that my great grandmother was sending to my grandfather. And it just opened up a whole new door. So I gained my identity by running away from what it was to be Italian in the United States and then running into what it was to be Italian in Italy. And I couldn't relate. I thought I was Italian in the United States and that I was trying to become American. When I went to Italy, I thought that I realized that I was an American who was trying to be Italian. I was caught in between these two. Yeah. And the result was, well, what am I? Am I American or Italian? And then I come back and Dominic Candeloro has this thing called the Italian American Project. I said, you know what? That's what I am. I'm an American. I'm born and raised American, but I'm from, you know, that's what makes me different. And so I spent the rest of my life studying both aspects. What does it mean to be American? What does it mean to be Italian? And that's I think what happens, you know, when you want to get beyond Columbus, we've got to get beyond this figure of the way that we may have found ourselves becoming Americans more easily. Columbus Day and Columbus parades and so on were not designed for Italians. They were designed for all Americans. How did Italians end up with it? Well, because they attacked it more zealously. They said, yes, this is how we become Americans. See, everything you have in this country is named after this man. This is our man. Well, Columbus, he sailed for Spain. He was a mercenary. He was a sailor. Yes, he was an explorer and so on, but he didn't do anything for Italy at all. And Italy wasn't even a unified nation to be doing anything for back then. And so what was it that enabled Italians to begin to take over the Columbus Day parades? Is because they started investing their time, their money, and their identity in this figure. And much to the dismay that I see later is we haven't been able to move beyond Columbus. And so that's what we need to do now. So when I wrote that article, I said, this is our wake-up call. All right, we're not forcing anybody to worship Columbus. We're not forcing everybody to believe everything there is in Columbus. But as Italian-Americans, many of us have found ways of identifying with Columbus. And the problem is, all the rest of the people in the United States don't understand what that connection is. It's our job, first, to understand why we're connected to Columbus, two, to be able to explain to other people why we are, and three, to move beyond it. So we can't keep driving into the future looking in our rearview mirror, using a metaphor created by the Gutenberg Galaxy guy, Marshall McLuhan.
Okay.
We can't keep moving forward looking backwards. And as long as we're focusing all our attention on Columbus, we're missing all the kids growing up. There's a new book that just came out by Rosemary Serra, the first Italian sociologist, the first even Italian-American sociologist to study the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth generations. What are they saying? You know, Italian-American clubs are saying, well, we have trouble getting youth and but they're not paying attention to the youth. And this book just came out, which was generously funded, partially funded, but generously through the National Endowment, National Italian American Foundation. The book just came out. It should be in bookstores. It's called A Sense of Origins.
A Sense of Origins. We should need to make sure we get that complete information.
Oh, we'll definitely have it.
This is the first I'm hearing of it too. That's wonderful.
Right. No, this is in a series, in my series at SUNY Press.
Okay.
When I first met this sociologist, I really encouraged her to study in the United States. And she did this fantastic book where she studied a large cohort of Italian American kids in the Northeast Corridor. And she's trying to replicate the study around the United States. So there's some very interesting things that are going on. But this sense of, this is what the youth have been doing while we've been marching in these parades and we've been celebrating our culture and having festas and so on and so forth. A lot of other things have been happening. And it's not just something that academics should pay attention to. It's something everybody should pay attention to.
Yeah, you hit on so many different topics there, Fred. I don't even know where to start. I mean, I think your story is typical. I think Frank can relate to it too, though. I mean, I am that fifth generation. You know, on the Simonini side, they came over in the 1870s. That I have any attachment at all to my ethnic heritage is kind of astounding these days. And yet I speak the language pretty well, and I went back to Italy. And there was a whole bunch of circumstances that led to that. I'm much closer to the immigrant experience on my mother's side, but even there, all my grandparents were born in the United States and some of my great-grandparents. So I have no living connection to the immigrant experience. Everything has happened, what has been passed down to me through the family. And that's good, but like you said, it's limiting. And that's what we're doing with, you know, the Italian American Studies programs, reaching out and letting people understand. Because when you don't have access to the information, you fill in the blanks with whatever's available, like you said, with Columbus and Capone were available in popular culture, or you extrapolate that your own family experience is universal, which it not isn't necessarily. I mean, I can say when you talk about La Miseria, I can tell you that on the Tuscan side, that was less emphasized, that side of the family. And maybe it's not a coincidence that I have more access to that history through my family because there was more of a sense of pride there. They came over and they were one of the first families, I think they were within the first 12 families to settle in Providence, Rhode Island. And, you know, they were benestante. They established businesses and whatnot. I remember my great aunt telling me as a little girl that her grandfather could read. And as a child, I didn't know the importance of what that meant. And now when I look at the calendar when he was born, they had the good luck of being born in Tuscany, which always had a better education system in that period than the rest of Italy. So they came over with a different set of circumstances than I think my mother's side of the family that came over from Campania and the Abruzzo region. And with that grandmother, it was silence. She wouldn't talk about certain things. You know, she'd do this with her hand.
When I moved to New York back in 19, I think I was like 40, 45, 46 years old, I started giving talks about Italian American culture, and somebody came up to me in one of the community talks and said, why are you always apologizing for being Italian? Mm-hmm. She goes, in New York, we're proud. And they were, and that was the difference. In Chicago, we had been taught not inside of our family, we had been taught to be proud of what we were inside. But we had not been taught to be proud of our culture in our schools, even though some of the schools I went to, like Sacred Heart Grammar School in Melrose Park, had a large majority of people who were Italian. We were not told by people, be proud that you're Italian, go out there and go, and we weren't handed books or anything about our culture. And so when The Godfather came along in 1969, and then in 72 as a movie, people began attaching themselves to that, not because of the gangster aspect, but because of everything else that went around it, because, wow, we saw ourselves in the mirror. There was a young African-American actress who told people that when she was growing up, she never saw herself reflected in the media. And when I heard that, I grabbed on that metaphor, and I was talking about it with my students in some of my early Italian-American classes. And I realized that there is one metaphorical character that comes out of folk history who, when they look in a mirror, they can't see themselves. And what is that? That's a vampire. And what do vampires do? Vampires live off of other people's blood. I said, this is what happens when your culture is not reflected. And if it is reflected, distorted so much that you don't want to identify with it, that you began looking for other ways to be who you are, other ways to identify with. And I think that's the key to looking. We can't look at the gangsters. We can't look at the actors. I wrote a book called From Wise Guys to Wise Men, which was trying to explain why we ended up with this stereotype. And it's because we have paid, and all America and all the world has paid much more attention to the wise guys than they have to the wise men. And I ask people, name a wise man who comes from American culture, and Benjamin Franklin, and then somebody said Gandalf, and Gandalf comes from Lord of the Rings. Yeah, he's a wise old wizard, but that's not American. And we need to understand who were our wise men and wise women and to study those and use those as the role models, and then things will change.
Well, I mean, speaking beyond Columbus, I'm the first to say I hope we do retain the day, the parade, the statues. However, we need to be beyond Columbus, even if we keep Columbus.
That's the point.
Columbus is this minuscule little bitty fraction of our lives. And if we don't get smarter or educate our group, our community, especially our younger people, we're really going to die off. And when I say educate, I mean there's just so much to be proud of, to have knowledge of, inventions in so many ways that we touched America and daily American life that our kids don't know anything about it. And it's not an easy process. Believe me, I mean, you know better than me. You both do know better than me. I'm not a teacher. But Italian Americans are a funny group. We're good. We're proud. We're happy with what we are. Do we really know why? Not so much, and we're really not concerned with that. Right. And then you have a question of, you know, in the age of 2020, you know, even these fourth, fifth, sixth generations later, odds are they're not 100% Italian origin. So now in that family, they're competing with the other ethnicity of their background, and it makes it even harder.
Right. And I think the key to look, to what we're looking at here is what happens when we send our kids off to college. Because certainly when they go to college, they're going further away from home. So whatever Italian identity they may have gotten at home, they're going to rebel against that anyway, because the kids do that. But when they go away to college, and you know, I gave a talk a few years ago at the Order of Sons of Italy in America, at their Grand Lodge in New York, at their scholarship, because Italian Americans are wonderful about giving scholarships. They believe we gotta educate our kids. But what happens is they don't tie anything to that scholarship. They don't say, okay, they say, here's a couple thousand dollars. We hope you do well in college. Be good. You know, you've done well so far. We were going to encourage you. But they don't make any restrictions to that. And there should be some expectations set. You need to, you know, if you're going to take this scholarship, you need to study a year of Italian. You need to study some Italian-American courses. Now, the courses weren't there years ago, but chances are you could find more and more now. We need to have more Italian-American studies throughout the United States. But you can find some that weren't there, and you can even go into some immigration courses and maybe write a paper about Italian-Americans, but you couldn't do that for the last two or three generations. When I told them that they should stop giving money to students and they should start giving money to build education programs, they looked at me like I was from outer space. They said, no, we have to give money. We have to encourage. I said, when you encourage students to go to schools where there are no Italian American studies programs and they're not likely to take any of those courses, you're encouraging them to move further and further away from Italian American culture. And if you spent some time, if we took all, you know, I said, if you took all the money that all the Italian American organizations and did a moratorium for 1 year, you would be able to create two or three programs in Italian American studies and then give the scholarships and have people go to those schools or have people, you know, ask about Italian American studies. I told the students, when you are given a gift, you know, why do people give gifts? Well, we give gifts for a lot of reasons, but sometimes we give gifts because we want people to connect to us. These gifts don't connect. And sometimes they say, well, we'll give you a free year's membership in our organization. Everybody takes that because they're not going to say no to it during that first year, but not very few of them sign up the next year and so on. Plus, being in college is not the time to be inside these organizations, you know, especially when you're starting a young family. If you look at most of the organizations have always been run by professionals who've had time outside of their jobs or people who were retired who could dedicate the rest of their retired life to running these organizations. And so we need to move beyond that. And that's something you can get at through that book by Rosemary Serra, A Sense of Origins, because this is what the students say. They say in these interviews why they are not members of these organizations. The number one thing they say is they don't listen to us. They don't listen.
So, what I would love to see is we missed the boat maybe 5-6 decades ago when we didn't have an Italian school on Saturday, like the Greeks, like the Polish, like the Jewish, because that really instilled the language, the history, and the religion. And we didn't do it. So now, looking to today, I would love to see, instead of maybe these scholarships, creating where we could have contests and sponsor a group to go to Italy for maybe a 17, 18 year old, where I'm pretty sure odds are that's going to affect his ethnic awareness for a lifetime. And if you have these kids write in and actually earn this spot and then bring 100 kids a year, well, now 100 kids will probably be affected in a much sharper way than a $2,000 scholarship to go towards their philosophy 101 class.
Right. There was a program even 20, 30 years ago at the Italian Cultural Center, still has it in Stone Park. And I forced my kids into that language program every Saturday. And Saturdays are the days when they were going to go play with their friends and so on and so on. And they fought me. They hated it. But both of them went on and studied Italian in high school and college. And I told them when they were in college, after you finish 2 years of Italian, I'm going to bring you to Italy. And I brought them to Italy, and I took them all over. And then I took them, you know, to the places that they wanted to see. Then I took them to our family. And that changed their lives. So much so that I've been reluctant to look for, to get my Italian citizenship. I should have got it 30 years ago when Silvio Marchetti was the consul attaché, cultural attaché in Chicago. And he says, hey, we're developing this new thing. Why don't you apply for citizenship? I said, yeah, I'll do it. Well, I'm doing it now, not for me so much, but for my kids. They want it. And you're right. If we sent those kids to Italy, they would then be able to confront Italy on their terms, and they would see, and almost every kid who goes to Italy comes back. We have a program now at the Calandra Institute where, because we haven't been able to install a very strong PhD program in Italian American Studies anywhere, we have what's called the Italian Diaspora Studies Summer Seminar. This past summer, we had to pass it up because of the COVID. But we take professors and graduate students who want to further their knowledge of Italian American culture, and we bring them to Rome, and we work with the leading scholars in Italian American studies, and they develop courses that they'll teach, they develop articles that they'll write, and so on and so forth. That's at the higher end, and we can only do that now because we've already had some programs at the undergraduate level. Italian is still very strong out here on Long Island, but how much stronger and how much longer will it be held up in the schools outside of where there's any kind of a large Italian population?
Yeah, well, that's a big issue right now. I know my colleagues who do the, I mean, I come out of an Italian studies background. I taught Italian. I ran an Italian program at my former job at Youngstown State University, and I'm very vested in continuing the language studies. And it's interesting. It's in decline in the U.S., but so are other language studies, whereas Italy, the Italian is still, it's the fifth most studied language in the world. So there's a great demand to learn the language from people who have no attachment to it necessarily, other than recognizing it as a means of exploring a very rich and interesting culture. So I'm all for bringing students abroad. I know NIAF, the National Italian American Foundation, offers a program to Italy, but I think part of that is, again, drawing a little bit on my own experience, because me studying abroad was transformative as well. You know, I did not learn Italian in the household. It was not a language that was spoken. I mean, you talk about how you spoke. I mean, I spoke like a book, they told me, and I probably still do, because I didn't grow up. I don't have the nuance of the accent and all that. So me being there, again, I had that experience of feeling so very American, but also it opened up a new way of looking at things. And there is a differentiation. I'm glad to hear that you took them also to your hometowns, because there's a tendency, I think, still, and it goes way back into 19th century America's fascination, all the Italophiles, to look at high Italian culture, which is wonderful. I mean, who doesn't want to explore? I mean, that I was attracted to that. Dante and the Renaissance and all those wonderful things. And that's very important. But then to bring it down to the level where it relates to the Italian American experience is important as well. So you don't want to just go to all the great museums and look at all the high culture, but also, hey, you know, like you said, why did people leave? I remember thinking that too. I'm like, Dad, it's beautiful here. And when they had, ma non si mangiava, you know, you didn't eat. You didn't eat. And you need to be able to talk about that. You talked about so much. Just one other thing I wanted to mention is this idea of seeing yourself represented in the curriculum, how important that is. I mean, that's the justification behind all ethnic studies programs. And it is important. And looking at our commonalities, but also our uniqueness. Yes, the Italian story is part of a greater immigrant story that's part of American history, but it's also unique for its own particular aspects of it. And to be able to talk about that and make connections, I think for me as a teacher, that's the most rewarding part of my work. I've been able to create courses here at Loyola that are part of the core curriculum. So you get students who are from, who have to fulfill their general ed requirements, as we would call them. And it's interesting to see how many other students from different ethnic backgrounds, different nationalities, never mind backgrounds, that make connections. So how meaningful it is in terms of a scholarly inquiry, a critical inquiry.
That's the first thing I did when I created Italian American Studies courses, is to make sure that they had general studies, they fulfilled general studies requirements. Mm-hmm. I ended up with people from all different cultures. I had a lot of Italian Americans, and it would frustrate me when the Italian American student would get a C in the course, and an Asian or a Latin American student would get an A.
Not that's because of, me, you know, too, I mean, Fred. That's you know, me too.
but for example, right now I'm teaching a graduate seminar in Italian American literature, and of the 12 students that I have enrolled in that, only three are Italian American. And I asked them, why did you sign up for this class? Oh, I've never learned anything about Italian Americans. I want to learn something. You know, I know about African American, Jewish American, Asian American. I want, you know, and this is the first, and I'm ecstatic about this. I mean, I wish that this could have happened 30 years ago. But it took time, and it took time for people like me to have the confidence to be able to fight and fight and fight administrations to be able to get this in. You know, one time I asked somebody, you know, have you ever gone to your library and looked for books by Italian Americans? And they said, well, no. I said, they said they don't have books by Italian Americans there. I said, libraries will order what you tell them to order. You go in there and you tell them. You know, and a perfect example of that is a novel I'm teaching right now, Paper Fish by Tina DeRosa. Dominic Candeloro, when her book came out, he held a series of authors reading series in the libraries. And so at least those libraries had those books. I mean, it's got to be engineered. You have to not only study the culture, teach the culture, write about the culture. You have to advocate for it. You have to work politically. We work very strongly. In New York, there's a very strong Italian American political group in the state legislators. The majority of the state legislators, are Italian American. Some of them don't have their, and that's why Italians have power in New York. That's exactly why they have, and that's why we didn't have power in Chicago. And that's why things like the Italian American Political Action Committee in Chicago was created to try to create that. And Italian Americans do not vote as a bloc the way they once might have when they first were Republicans, because they thought Republic was like the Republic of Italy, Abraham Lincoln, and so on and so forth. And then, you know, due to politics, they made the shift for a while into the Democratic Party, Party of the Worker, and so on and so forth. And then everybody's all over the place now. So it really behooves us to take stock of where we have been as a culture and what we're doing now as a culture. There was so much money raised to preserve and protect Columbus that, and I believe that, you know, that's important for some people, but I keep thinking about all the money that could have been spent on building Italian American studies programs. But, you know, I think it took a while. But Unico was certainly behind it. I remember Paul and Ann Rubino were the first chapter of Unico to have women as members, and they were threatened to be thrown out. In fact, they were banned from Unico for a while because they allowed women into that. And they were pioneers. And here he is again, the pioneer in spearheading this campaign for this chair. And we need. And Paul is one of hundreds of thousands of Italian Americans, Paul and Ann, at their level, where they're in a position to be able to give back. You know, people once complained when we were raising money for the chair at Stony Brook that we had taken some money from some gangster. And I said, I don't care who gives us the money. I really don't care. We're not going to name the chair after the gangster.
I'm not a smart guy, but what did Machiavelli say?
Love your wait. Well,
that justifies the means.
Oh yes, of course.
You got to have the program.
Oh right, I'll take the money from anybody to do it, and So this is, you know, this is where we need to be right now. And a lot of those people who are spearheading the, you know, to preserve Columbus have been very good donors to Italian American Studies and so
yes,
on.
Yes, they have. Yes. Yes, they have. So, and we want
but
to.
Unfortunately, I don't mean to interrupt, but unfortunately, you know, I was through the process of trying to raise the money and get this going in Chicago. And, you know, shockingly, not every Italian American organization cared about it, believed in it, donated to it, thought it even was, you know, necessary. Obviously not every Italian American did, but I mean, the organizations is really what was a little disappointing, because if you're an Italian American organization, how do you not think that it's important that we have an Italian American studies program in our own city? So if you got to convince them of that, that's sad. And these are the people that could make a difference with the youth, with educating, with Italian language programs, and not to be, you know, too negative, but they really don't. I don't think they see it as an important thing. And that's what really scares me, when our leaders don't really see the vision for the future. So right. We got to get beyond, not only beyond Columbus, beyond them. That right. might be a bigger picture here.
Yeah, but I think a lot of those people grew up and didn't have college education as a way to move ahead. They moved ahead through hard work. They moved ahead because they went from being a ditch digger to a contractor, whatever. And so they didn't see the value of that. When I used to go around and try to raise money for the Italian American Studies program at Stony Brook, I would ask people, I said, do you have a friend who's a lawyer? Oh, yeah, I have a friend. I go to him all the time. You have a friend who's a plumber? Oh, yeah, whenever something is wrong in my house, I know who to call. An electrician? Oh, I got a friend. I said, do you have a friend in the university? He said, well, what do I need a friend in the university for? I said, how many of you are sending your kids to college? Oh, my kids are all going to college. I said, when those kids are having problems in college, who do they go to? They go to a counselor. I don't know. I said, wouldn't you rather have them go to a friend? And the guy says, I never thought of that. I said, think of me as your friend in the college. I raised so much money for that, because you have to be able to understand, especially when you're speaking to these people, because I come from the streets. I had trouble separating the streets from the academy when I went into the academy. I was always afraid that my Melrose language was going to come out. I was going to get mad. And I've gotten mad. And I'm one of the few people, I think, who threw a book down on the ground in the middle of a meeting. And the whole meeting just turned around like I was the devil in the audience. He's Italian. That's his temper, or so on and so forth. But you have to know how to speak to the people. And you also have to, I belonged. I once figured out that if you got a dollar from every Italian American in Chicago, you could build an Italian American studies program every year. And it seemed so easy. It seemed so easy to do about it. I mean, one of the great people who really advocated not just the work that I was doing, but the work that the Fra Noi was doing, was a man by the name of Tony Fernelli.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. Tony was... I remember the first time I went into his lawyer's office, I was so intimidated by it. And he just kind of welcomed me and he opened the door and he made me see that there was this human being behind this profession that he was in. And that this human being understood what it meant to be Italian. And even though he didn't know everything that I seemed to know about Italian America, he wanted to know more. And those are the kinds of people in Chicago, the Rubinos, the other people who gave money to the chair there. Those are the leaders, and things will happen. You know, when Carla starts having students and sending those students out into the community, and they're going, where'd you learn that from? I had students when I was at Stony Brook, they would go home. I told them, your job now is to take what you learn and go home, go to your neighborhoods, go to your parents and tell them what you learned. And I had a number of students send, their parents would come to my class. Can I come in? And a grandmother came in, and I said something in class once, and the grandmother raised her hand. Professor, I think you're wrong. You know, and she corrected me on some kind of thing about the enemy alien. I was talking about the enemy, and she had been noted as an enemy alien. We had to do this. We had to, and she was became the most wonderful fount of knowledge. I said, can I have you come? She goes, I'll come and do it, and I'll bring food. So that's to me, that's if someone said, okay, Fred, we're going to let you retire now, but what we want you to do is we want you to go around the country and speak to Italian American. That would be my dream job. The next, if I have another dream job, it would be going and speak. Because every time when I, you know, up until recently, because of the COVID, I would travel everywhere. I was rarely home more than 3 weeks at a time. And wherever I went, I always looked for the Italians. If you know, it was a neighborhood, it was a city, it was out in the country. And I would find the Italians and I would sit and I would talk and I would listen to them. And to me, that's something that needs to be done. We need somebody to go hitchhiking around the country talking to Italian Americans.
Yeah. I volunteer.
So will I.
I would love to.
I second the nomination, Frank. I think you'd be great.
We'll do it like Starsky and Hutch or Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. We'll do it for culture. We'll do it for culture.
No, you're definitely right. You have to talk to the people. But I think, you know, when people like Dominic Candeloro and Anthony Fornelli, they have a sincerity that they cared. They genuinely cared about the future of Italian Americans. There's not a lot of them out there like that. I wish there were more. You know, there are good groups that did back the Italian American Studies program at Loyola. Unfortunately, a lot of them, they're kind of just, this is our group. We do our stuff. We do our dinner dance. We have our man of the year. We give $10,000 in scholarships and that's it. We call it a day and we're okay with that without that vision for, no, we need to do more. We need to make a difference. And that's what I think as a community, Italian American community, we need to do more. We need to take a proactive approach with our youth or the generation after this one. We may be just down to restaurants and that's about it. So
the key I think here is the difference between raising money and raising consciousness. And a lot of times people said, well, I hated even selling Little League candy when I was a kid. Once I left my those chocolate bars, I left them outside and I went to play baseball and I came back, they were all melted. My father beat me because he said, now I got to buy that whole box of chocolate because it all melted. I didn't want to go up to people, knock people's door. Would you buy a candy bar for a Little League? You know, but I said, I can't raise money, but I could raise consciousness, you know? And when I started taking that tack, things began to change because you're not trying to go into somebody's pocket and take out their money. You're going into their mind. And when you do that, their hand goes into their pocket and says, because Italian Americans are helping people. They help everybody. We're caretaking almost to a crime. We take care of people. When we understand what it is we're doing, if it's a relative who's sick or it's a friend of a relative who needs some, we're the first there to help. Even people we don't know in Italy, when there's floods and when there's earthquakes and so on, we give a lot of, you know, that money. And we just have to be aware and it has to be in our conscience.
Well, I like this vibe. We have a lot of work to do, but we could do it.
Absolutely. There's no doubt.
You know, and to pick up on like some of the positive things that have happened, that, I mean, the fact that I'm here and that I have this job, that $500,000 was raised to make this position possible, that Dominic Candeloro, who was out there tirelessly advocating for raising the funds, that we had a sympathetic president here at Loyola, Father Garanzini, who pledged to match the funds. And I continue to have a lot of support from the current administration, our associate dean, Art Lorigio and whatnot. I took my lesson from you, Fred, about giving back too. When my first year I was here, Dominic had a calendar for me. I think I told you this, I went to 34 different events. So sometimes I spoke, sometimes, and I'm shy, you know I'm shy. So for me, that was a big energy thing to get up in front of people and say a few words. Sometimes I was just there and Dominic introduced myself, but I made sure I went out and met every single group that gave anything to the program, or as many as I could. And the other thing we try to do with the Italian American Studies program is these outreach programs. We have one every semester that I've been given. The foundation, the fund allows me to have events. COVID's made that a little bit difficult. That's why this is our event this time, a virtual one with the interviews. And we invite the people in. And Casa Italia, that you mentioned before, they still have their Sunday Italian classes and we've partnered with them. Dominic, you know, is very involved there. He is the curator of their collections in the library and he oversees a group of volunteers. A lot of times, the distance, I found out moving to Chicago, people don't like, I mean, it's a big city, you know, it takes hours sometimes to get from one side to the other, especially with the traffic. So when we would do something at Loyola and Dominic would say, people aren't going to come to the Loyola campus, it's far, there's no parking, we would bring the guest speakers in and do a second event at Casa Italia. And we got good attendance. I mean, not, you know, always you're hoping for more, but I want to give a special shout out to the Mark Gajana Society, because Frank and I have talked about this before. We go to a lot of these events where scholarships are offered, and there, like you said, there's no encouragement along with that scholarship to explore the Italian American experience or history. The Mark Gajana Society pledged $5,000 to any student who would come to Loyola, who had an affiliation with the club, and who would follow the Italian American Studies minor.
I believe they were, correct me if I'm wrong, Carla, weren't they the first ones to back Dominic to put down the money when, at that point, he might have been asking for $22 million in the eyes of the public? Mm-hmm. When he needed $500,000, these people put down money, I tip my hat to them, yes. Mm-hmm.
So we have, you know, there's things are happening, I think. And again, I think, see, Fred, your work is certainly, you know, trailblazing in this area, and we're trying to carry it on. And that's why we wanted to do this series, too. I mean, one thing about this whole thing with Columbus, we're going to put up the links. One thing that you mentioned in your article is for Italian Americans to become informed about why we're so attached to Columbus in the first place, that we don't even know that history. Like, there's this sense of attachment to it. People aren't they're unable to decouple, I think is an exact quote in one of the articles, their Italian ethnic identity with the celebration of Columbus. And it doesn't have to be just that. There are reasons why the community was involved with Columbus. Let's understand them and let's explore. Is it still relevant today? Maybe it is, maybe it's not, but we should be able to make an informed, instead of just a nostalgic or emotionally based decision on that, and go forward from there and encourage our young people. I was brought in this direction. You know, if I hadn't had a series of events that happened in my life that brought me into touch with different ways of studying about Italy, and then via Italy, I learned about my Italian American heritage and identity, and mine is just one. There's so many different stories out there. My family coming from Tuscany and my on one side and the Abruzzo on another is different from somebody who came, you know, from the Pugliese or a different social class. Those are multiple Italian American identities that need to be explored and valued and made sense of in terms of both the big picture with the Italian, with the immigrant experience, and then the particular, what makes us who we are. So that's my my little concluding thoughts there.
And I always like to, I love when they're proud, and then but they don't, you know, and I say, well, you know, it's great they're proud, but when I say, well, did you know that we're responsible for modern banking? They go, really? And I tell them about who it is, and they go, oh my God. And then I go, do you know we're responsible for modern accounting? Really? And I tell them who it is, and they go, oh my God. I love that reaction, and that's what we got to do more of. And I believe that wishful thinking, COVID's going to go away, and then we're really going to hit the trail.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I can't wait to start getting around and start talking, because it's about the connections.
Yes.
And the one thing I've loved about using the Zoom that we're going to now is that we're still connecting. We're still making those connections. You know, I have writers come and visit my classes that I could never afford to pay for and put up, especially in New York. But they're coming, you know, Rita Ceresi, Mark Shabatari, they're coming to visit my classes. And when the students see the writers there, I mean, I could just imagine what would have happened had Tina DeRosa been able to be, you know, her book has done very well, she's dead now, but had she been able to speak to classes around, you know, what more could we have done? So I think what you're doing and what Frank's doing with the Zoom is honorable, fantastic. It's good hard work. And I think it's good seeding for future connections, because it's all about making the connections. I mean, I never connected to Frank before, but next time I'm going to Chicago, we're going out somewhere.
Absolutely. I can't wait. Yes. You're going to take me on the road with you. You promise.
Yeah, I'd love to do that.
Well, Fred, thank you so much for your time, for all your knowledge, and for all your passion, most of all.
Thank you again.
Thank you. Grazie di cuore. You've heard me say it many times. You know how sincerely that is voiced to you.
Anytime you need me, call me.
All right. Well, and we're going to put up those links. Like I said, two scholars that Professor Gardafei recommends are Laura Ruberto and Joseph Sciorra, who write a lot about the history of Columbus. And we'll put up the link also to your own article that we were talking about, Beyond Columbus. And also we'll find, we'll get that exact information about.
I'll send it to you as soon as we get off. I'll send it to you.
Okay. I'm anxious to read that myself. I really am. So, okay.
All right. Well, thank you both.
Thank you.
Great interview. Thank you.
Grazie. Ciao, ciao. Grazie.